KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
The high in the low 40s.
Sort of strange to be asked to talk in a library. When I was young, I was often told not to.
Here we are, once again, at the end of the year, staring at a crisis we should have dealt with literally months ago.
Thanks to the votes of Democrats and Republicans in Congress, I will sign a law that raises taxes on the wealthiest 2% of Americans, while preventing a middle class tax hike that could have sent the economy back into recession and obviously had a severe impact on families all across America.
President Obama on signing the legislation avoiding the fiscal cliff. You also heard Mitch McConnell talking about that. And at the beginning, David Wagner, the poet and novelist, talking about, well, what it was like to be a little kid and have a librarian shush you. We will talk with Wagner coming up this hour on weekday. But we're going to start looking at the aftermath of the fiscal cliff. Nothing seems to have squashed, but yet new politics unfolding. Jill Jackson is Capitol Hill producer for CBS News. She's been tracking this. Hello, Jill.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. I see gummy bears are delicious, and tonight they're your dinner, which means that's what was on your Twitter feed, which means you were spending a lot of time in the hallways, prowling the halls, eating, sharing gummy bears with the Congress members, huh?
That's right. It was delicious. I have to say, I was really happy to have those gummy bears. But no, it really was a dramatic day yesterday, just with House Republicans coming in. They met early in the afternoon, and Leader Cantor, the number two Republican in the House, came out against the Senate passed bill, despite the overwhelming support in that chamber for it. That led a lot of Republican members of the rank and file to also oppose it, though many would likely have anyway. And after a couple hours, leaders emerged, and they decided that they were going to see what they could possibly do, but it was looking like they might change the Senate bill itself, in which case then it would have to go back to the Senate. So leaders met behind closed doors for a couple hours after that meeting. Then Harry Reid came out in the Senate and said, if you amend it, we will not take it up, which basically meant the House Republicans were left with the hot potato that was responsibility for allowing the country to go over the fiscal cliff. They met with members again and decided that the only way forward was they could see if there was enough support for going over the cliff, which meant amending the bill, or seeing if the bill itself could pass on its own. They did a quick whip count and decided to bring the Senate bill as it was to the floor, despite the number one complaint from Republicans that it did not include enough spending cuts.
So it passed the House 257 to 167. What's the mood among the most earnest Tea Party members of the Republican caucus today?
Well, they're unhappy. They think that the bill, you know, again, once again, they feel like they got rolled. The same thing happened a year ago on the payroll tax cut extension, where the Senate passed a bill overwhelmingly, again with 89 votes like this time. Then House Republicans wanted to fight. They wanted to change it. It was right before Christmas, and at the end of the day, Speaker Boehner knew it wasn't going to fly. He managed to get the House to approve the payroll tax extension despite the objections from the Republicans. This time, the Speaker again brought it to the floor, was willing to really put his speakership on the line. And we saw something we rarely see, and that is a divided leadership vote for this package. Boehner voted for it. Number two, Eric Cantor, voted against it. Number three, Kevin McCarthy, voted against it. So they're kind of, you know, the new Congress starts tomorrow, and the Republicans are going into it on a very divided note.
Do you think that division among the leadership was deliberate to allow the Tea Party part of the Republican Party to feel like they still have people on their side in leadership?
Well, in some ways, I think that if all of GOP leadership had voted for the package, then the Republicans would not have believed that there really weren't enough votes to amend the bill. So that could have definitely backfired. That being said, I think that it's been a rocky road over the past couple years for Speaker Boehner and Majority Leader Eric Cantor, and I think that there was some real strain and difference of opinion in what the best way forward was with this. I think that, you know, in some ways, Eric Cantor was ready to have that fight where the House could what they wanted to do was add $300 billion in spending cuts that would replace the sequester and send that back to the Senate and let the Senate have the hot potato. But in some ways, I think Speaker Boehner just realized that that wasn't going to go anywhere, and basically what would end up happening is the Republicans would all be blamed for going over the fiscal cliff, which would have disastrous political consequences.
Well, now they have 2 months. They've hooked the sequester to the debate over the debt ceiling. The Obama administration, I guess, is gambling that they still will look bad if they try to push the debt ceiling issue too hard. But the Republicans, what's their mood in terms of that connection and the debt ceiling battle?
They actually roll their eyes when they hear the Democrats say that this time Republicans won't or should not put up any fight on the debt ceiling. I mean, the Speaker's rule in the past has been for every dollar that the debt ceiling is increased, there needs to be a corresponding dollar in cuts. I would expect that same demand this time around, and I think Republicans will make it a fight, despite the fact that even Vice President Biden, when he met with House Democrats yesterday on the Hill, he told them this time would be different, that wouldn't happen, but we're fully expecting a full-on fight over the debt ceiling again. We also have 1 month after the debt ceiling is expected to be taken up, we'll have funding for the government run out, and Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, Republican, said today that he expects a big fight over that as well. So I think, you know, basically this next Congress is going to be look very much like the last 2 years, where it will be jumping from one budget and economic fight to the next.
So we have the debt ceiling, the sequester, and then the funding for the government all rolling one on top of another?
That's right. Some people are starting to call it you'll appreciate this in the Pacific Northwest, the Cascades of the fiscal Cascades.
So
many little cliffs.
And this new Congress is not that much different in terms of its political makeup than the last Congress. So nobody's expecting much change.
No, I think that it's going to look very much the same, and we'll have these fights. And one thing that I think a lot of people, you know, forget is that what House Republicans are most concerned about is not losing to a Democrat, because the majority of them are in safe conservative districts where electing a Democrat just isn't going to happen. What they're most concerned about is being primaried from the right. And so that is why in many cases we see these big fights and the Republicans going so far to the right, is that they are more concerned about being challenged in a primary, as they've seen some of their colleagues go down in primaries over the past two cycles for not being conservative enough. So that's just something to keep in mind as we watch these fights. The funny thing is, though, you know, a lot of people are saying that Republicans really did get quite an excellent deal out of this fiscal cliff package. I mean, 98 to 99% of the Bush tax cuts have been extended and made permanent. That is something that I think in some ways supporters of the package don't understand why Republicans don't see that as so much of a victory. But I think it comes down to the fact that so many of them ran in 2010 and won on cutting spending and bringing down the deficit. And all we've seen over the past 2 years is the deficit continue to go up.
All right, Jill, I thank you for bringing us up to date on what was happening. And I hope you have better dinner plans for tonight.
Thanks so much.
Jill Jackson is Capitol Hill producer for CBS News, talking to us about the vote on the fiscal cliff. The vote to avert the fiscal cliff. Representative Jim McDermott, congressman from Washington's 7th District, was one of the Democrats voting against the deal. Congressman McDermott, thanks for talking to us this morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you. Happy New Year.
It's good. It's going to be an interesting year. I don't know if it's going to be good or not, but we'll see.
All right, so do you agree with what we just heard Jill Jackson saying, that putting the Bush tax cuts permanently in place, was that one of the things that you didn't like about this deal?
Well, that was the least of the problems. I think certainly the tax cuts for the middle class were the main reason we were there, and nobody ever thought they were going to be allowed to go up. I mean, that clearly was not going to happen. What was going to happen was increases on the people at the top end of the economic ladder, and I think the president negotiated very poorly in getting only $400,000 at the limit. It should have been $250,000. He ran on it twice. He got elected on it. He promised it to the people, and then he walked in there and came away with half of what he said he was going to get.
Why did he do that, do you think?
You'd have to ask him. I have no idea.
If I could, Congressman, I would. Well, the argument is that half a loaf, isn't it? He got half a loaf, and couldn't he press for further tax increases on the wealthy down the line?
If that was the only thing that we were talking about here, Steve, it would be, that might be true. But basically, you're talking about one little battle in a great big war that's been going on in this country since 2000, when we put those tax cuts in and then went to war twice without paying for it. And we never paid for the tax cuts. We never paid for the wars. And now we're trying to straighten it all out. And this little bill here didn't do anything. What we're going to have is a huge, huge fight around the end of March. The continuing resolution, which is how we fund the government, expires. You've got the debt limit has already been exceeded on the 1st of January, and the Treasury is adjusting a few things here and there, and they're gonna really bring down the hammer sometime in mid-February. So you have a number of things that are coming together for the perfect storm again in February. We didn't deal with them today. We didn't deal with them yesterday. We could have dealt with them, but we decided to kick it down the road, and I personally think that was a mistake.
How could we have dealt with them? What would you have liked to have seen happen, and what will you argue for as we get closer to March?
Well, the first thing is the sequester business. This going after the budget and just doing across-the-board cuts doesn't make any sense at all if you're thinking seriously about a government that you want to function. You can't just whack. If I come into your radio station and say, I'm going to take 10% out of every program in here, some programs, you're just going to have to take them off the air, because that 10% will do away with your ability to put it on the air. And that's going to happen all across the government. And we're talking about medical research. We're not putting money in for medical research. We're not putting money in for any kind of stimulus for infrastructure. When the Republicans took over under Eisenhower, they built the national highway system. They didn't believe that investment in infrastructure was bad, but these guys do. And they don't believe, they also gave away something called the GI Bill. They invested in human infrastructure. And we have a group of people running the House of Representatives who don't believe in investing one single damn dime in the future.
But didn't you get some spending increases in this bill that otherwise you would not have gotten, and investments that you were talking about? The wind credit was extended. Heck, Washington State got its income tax write-off extended, sales tax write-off extended.
In every compromise, there are some good things. I'm not saying this was all bad. I worked hard to get that sales tax exemption put in there. But I do not think that means that you should give it up, because what we did today, and you listen to the Republicans as they talk about this, they say, well, I voted for my tax increase. Now, from here on out, all I'm talking about is cuts. And all you're going to hear when we come to March is cuts. And it'll be cuts not only in discretionary spending, like, you know, research in medical schools and that kind of stuff, but you're also talking about going after Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid and everything else. They simply said, I gave it the office on the 31st of December 2012, and I'm not ever given again. And you watch what happens when the battle is joined sometime in mid-March. And I mean, I know that's going to happen, and the president had maximum leverage at this point. He had them against the wall, and he let them breathe.
Well, he didn't seem to think he had them against the wall, did he? I mean, were you in on that Joe Biden pep talk? What did Joe Biden say about some of that stuff?
Well, I was there. I listened. But I guess the best way to put it is I remain unconvinced. When the president or Joe Biden tries to sell to us the idea that the president is going to say, I'm not going to negotiate about the debt limit. I'm just not going to do it. Well, sir, then I guess you're not going to get anything done because you're going to negotiate about anything that Mitch McConnell puts on the table. Let me tell you what I think is the biggest vote coming, and don't miss it, is the vote on the rules for the Senate. If the Senate doesn't change those filibuster rules, what you're seeing right now and have seen for the last 4 years, you're going to see for four more years. Because he is running. He's the one that negotiates. That's the name you hear, is Mitch McConnell. Who the hell is he? Is he the Speaker? No. Is he the majority leader of the Senate? No. He's the minority leader in the Senate, and yet he's the one that goes and negotiates with the Vice President of the United States and comes out with a deal. Now, what does that say about his power? He may not have a power in title, but he has power in reality.
And that reality stems from their ability to control the debate through the filibuster rules.
Absolutely. Well, they can prevent anything from coming to the floor. They can prevent anything from being voted on. And when you have that kind of process control, then a lot of this other stuff, the talk about the, you know, the flowery stuff we're going to do for the people and for the middle class and for everybody, turns out to be, it really, there's no reality to it.
So you think, Congressman McDermott, that the president is going to be faced with this, the fight over sequester, the fight over ending the funding for the government going away, the fight over the debt limit, and he's going to draw a line in the sand, and then he's going to erase it?
I hope not. I'm not predicting that. But I'm saying that he set up a situation where that is going to be a possibility, because it's all going to be on the table.
You don't think anybody, he can come back and offer more tax increases on the wealthy or others? You think it's just going to be cuts?
Yep. I don't know what he'll offer. He may want to offer some other things. See, here's the issue. If you look at government and you say, we have $10, what kind of government can we buy with $10? Then you get whatever you get for $10. If you say, how much government do we need? And we decide on that, and then we say, it's going to cost us $40, then we got to go find the $40. That's what I sit on the Ways and Means Committee, and I've sat on one since 1977 in the state legislature. The Ways and Means Committee is the ways and means to fund a civil society government that you want to answer the problems. We got this battle today where the Republicans refuse to bring up Sandy relief, and because it's all New Yorkers. I mean, it's New York, New Jersey, and only 12% of their caucus is from that area, so they just blew it off. When Mount St. Helens blew, Warren Magnuson went out on the floor of the Senate and mumbled a few words and said, we need $1 billion to clean this mess up, and they stuck it in the sea mammals bill, and it got passed in lightning speed. But when you have people who will not deal with the crisis created by Sandy, they've already forgotten about all those pictures on television and everything else. They don't want to clean up the mess. You've got people who don't want to function in government.
All right, sir. We're going to look. We will track it with you as the months roll out.
Okay.
Welcome to 2013. I appreciate you talking to us.
Sure thing. See ya.
Jim McDermott is a congressman in Washington's 7th District. This is Weekday.
Good morning. It's 9:24. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle News and Information. I'm Andy Hurst. What words or phrases would you like to hear less of or not at all in 2013? YOLO, perhaps? Fiscal cliff? Kick the can on down the road? KUOW's Ross Reynolds takes your phone calls at noon today, and we welcome your thoughts right now at our feedback line, 206-221-3663. That's 206-221-3663.
Support for KUOW comes from the Bush School, where students are challenged to reach beyond the conventional expectations of learning to use their education to make a difference in the world. K-12 open house in January. More information at bush.edu.
We have sunny skies and 38 degrees in the U District. We're expecting sun all day, the high reaching 41. It's going to be partly cloudy tonight and cold, the low near 31.
An Alaskan storm caused Shell's conical drilling unit, the Kulik, to run aground Monday night as it was being brought back to Puget Sound for more work. The damage is still being assessed, but oil leakage is not being detected at this point. It does raise the question again, though, whether Shell can drill in the Arctic for the oil they think is under the Chukchi Sea. Jennifer DeLuey is a national correspondent covering energy and other issues for Hearst newspapers and the Houston Chronicle. She's been reporting on the Kulik, which ran aground in Alaska on Monday night. Jennifer, thanks for talking to us.
Oh, of course. Nice to be with you.
I was reading your fuelfix.com blog, and you have been tracking this thing as it has unfolded. Any surprises for you in the way Shell or the U.S. or the Alaskan government have responded?
Well, you know, this is the whole thing is a bit of a surprise. So in that context, you know, I think this is something all of us are watching unfold, in interesting ways. Coast Guard officials have had to make a lot of decisions on the fly. While they're drawing on, you know, past exercises and past drills, they're making a lot of decisions very much in the moment, one of which was, you know, how much of the fuel to remove from the Kulik to reduce the risks of a spill. Some was offloaded, some was left on the vessel. That's one of the kinds of decisions that they're making quickly in the moment.
You report that the latest surveillance flights show no signs of a spill. What, 143,000 gallons of ultra-low sulfur diesel, 12,000 gallons of lubrication oil and hydraulic fluid are still on board the double-hulled rig. It's reportedly rocking. It's upright, rocking with a slow motion. That's according to some of the Shell folks that you quoted. What happened to it that it ended up so close to shore near these rocks?
Well, problems actually first began back on Thursday when, another boat called the Ivic was towing the Kulik in the Gulf of Alaska. The goal was to get, as you noted, down to Seattle for winter maintenance of the drilling rig. And the first of three successive storms basically came into the area. And amid these incredibly high seas, the Ivic lost its tow line to the Kulik. So that was the first problem. Then its engines failed. The four engines on the Ivic failed. A subsequent response mounted by Shell and the Coast Guard failed on four different occasions to get a tow line attached and to keep it attached to the Kulik. And the last failure basically came when they were towing it to safe harbor, what they thought would be safe harbor, and the storms were just so bad. A tow line snapped, and then another vessel made the decision to remove their tow line so as to protect the safety of the crew. They first, however, tried to steer it at least as close to shore as possible to prevent environmental damage or to minimize it.
Why was that? Why does that minimize it if you get it closer to shore?
Well, the closer it is to shore, frankly, the less battered it is. It's not in open sea conditions. Everyone across the board is saying that, you know, it is certainly more sheltered here than it was, you know, Friday when it was out in the open and, was being hit by waves that were, you know, four stories high and 70-mile-per-hour wind. So it's more sheltered. And, in fact, the weather today is a lot better. So there are some hopes that the crews will be able to get on the vessel to assess its integrity, to check really for more signs of a leak, and to see if this thing can be salvaged and safely removed.
How are they returning to the vessel? Do they get helicoptered in, or do they take little boats over, Zodiacs over, and somehow get up ladders?
You know, it's an aerial response, really, at this point. They've had two flights in the last 24 hours, one with a C-130 airplane and the other with a Jayhawk helicopter. The anticipation is that they will use a helicopter today to land a salvage crew on the vessel. There is, you know, this is an active or was an active drilling rig, so it has a helipad and it has accommodations for a helicopter. Now, of course, it doesn't have a crew to assist, you know, landing one there.
Right. Jennifer DeLuey reports for the Hearst newspapers on energy and oil. Fuelfix.com is one blog she puts a lot of stories into. She's been taking a look at what's happened to the Kulik, which has run aground, is that fair to say, as it was being towed back to Seattle. One last question here. So you have both the Coast Guard and Shell saying they're going to investigate what happened, why they weren't able to safely move this vessel down at this point. But right now they're saying their first priority is to respond to a spill. But you mentioned that the Coast Guard is reacting in time, but they do have a plan, don't they, when these things go into effect for how they're going to respond?
Yeah, so that's a really important question. We know they have contingency plans for a lot of different scenarios. When fellow reporters and I were asking the Coast Guard about the detail of that planning yesterday, the response essentially was that they've never planned for a rig to lose its tow line this many times and to be drifting, to beach itself on these rocks in such a scenario. So, you know, they're drawing on some planning, but there's nothing specifically for this kind of scenario. So it's challenging a lot of resources and thinking right now.
Jennifer DeLuey, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Jennifer DeLuey is a reporter for Hearst Newspapers. Lois Epstein is engineer, Arctic Program Director of the Wilderness Society, a member of an Interior Department Commission on Safe Offshore Drilling Practices. She's been quoted as saying, the implications of this incident are clear. Shell and its contractors are no match for Alaska's weather and sea conditions, either during drilling operations or during transit. Lois Epstein, sounds like that would go for the government and the Coast Guard as well.
Yeah, this is a really tough situation. The Coast Guard, I give them highest compliments for what they've done. They've done it without any major injuries, a few minor ones. And basically, we have a situation where there's not a spill right now. There's the rig is sitting near shore in a very sensitive area, but they're ready to assist the best they can should there be a spill. And that's what everybody's looking at right now. I've spent a lot of time thinking about the bigger picture issues, about what this means in terms of Shell's decision-making, the federal government's decision-making to go forward with Arctic drilling, and how challenging the Alaska conditions are. I'm here in Anchorage and spent a fair amount of time in the Arctic, so I have some sense of what problems they could encounter. But this is just showing that nature always wins in Alaska, and that's something we all say.
Well, how about what this tells us about what it would be like if this was in place, drilling, pumping oil in the Chukchi or Beaufort Seas?
Well, you've got two sets of issues. You have the drilling-related issues, and then you have the transit issues, which is what the problem was here. Both are critically important. Both are situations where the decision-makers have to figure out whether we have the equipment to go forward. I would argue, as an engineer and as someone who has a fair amount of experience on understanding what needs to be done offshore, both in the Gulf and in Alaska, that the conditions in Alaska are so different than in the lower 48 drilling, so challenging that we should all be raising fundamental questions about whether drilling in the Arctic is all that necessary given the risks involved. Here, where you have transit decisions, I would question whether Shell made the right decision. I think anybody would question that decision. All you have to do is stay in port when there are bad storms coming. Even if you've already left, you might have to turn around and might set your schedule back. But, you know, these were bad storms, but Shell were the only ones that got themselves in trouble. And what you have here is a rig that, just to be clear, doesn't have its own propulsion system. It relies on tugs to move. It's massive in size, 266 feet in diameter. The helicopters that removed the workers that were on the rig are tiny in the videos compared to the size of this rig. So you have a large bobbing bowling pin in 40-foot seas. Of course, a tow line is going to struggle to keep that thing under underway.
I guess I would think that there would be a tow line technology that would be compensating for that.
Well, not all rigs don't have their own propulsion systems. Some rigs are on drill ships. So there are some real serious design questions, whether a tow lines, no matter how strong, because it's a single line, and they had two of them. But, you know, when you're dealing with this very, very large piece of infrastructure, is that going to be enough? And if it wasn't enough, I would even question, why did they think it would be enough? Where, this industry has an enormous amount of hubris, thinking that they could deal with whatever the situation is that occurs. And, the rest of us, including the environment, end up suffering the consequences if they're wrong.
Well, on that note, Lois Epstein, here's what Shell writes on its webpage. They talked about the Kuluk being designed for safety. It has its own emergency rescue boat. Came to Alaska in 88. It's drilled in the Beaufort Sea at 167 feet of water. That was back in 88. Its target well depths this year could go over 12,000 feet. Been upgraded, like I said. Here's what they say. No oil company has ever operated in an environment as extreme as the Arctic, let alone with heritage equipment. Yet that's exactly the sort of challenge that makes the Arctic so appealing to many of us at Shell. On the slight chance that something goes wrong, Shell's spill cleanup plan is second to none. No one has yet fully determined how to clean up an oil spill in pack ice or broken ice, but that, too, is exactly the sort of challenge we love. What does that tell you?
Well, Shell has prides itself on being able to go beyond what other companies have done. They certainly have the resources to do that. That does not mean that they have enough resources and capability to deal with the Arctic. It's true they love a challenge, and it's true that the rig may have been designed to be safe under certain conditions, but it clearly wasn't designed for Alaska sea conditions that were encountered in the Gulf of Alaska. I don't think anyone's going to be able to say that, given what has happened. They put our Coast Guard personnel at extreme risk. This was extremely costly. I think the investors at Shell, the Green Eyeshade people, are going to have to look whether the Arctic is a place that they're really going to move forward in for over the long term, because this is an expensive, extremely difficult endeavor.
You really think they're going to question that? They're also counting up the potential for all that oil.
They have, the Kulik was to serve as a support rig for the Chukchi drilling ship, and vice versa. The Kulik was going to be the Beaufort and the Noble Discoverer and the Chukchi. Noble Discoverer has had its own set of problems and is stuck in Seward, Alaska right now. But if the damage to the ship is great, they're not going to be able to do that kind of operation this upcoming summer. And you either get another rig, which can't be done quickly, or you postpone your drilling. All this adds up cost-wise. And I think people are going to really have to ponder that over the long run.
Lois Epstein is an engineer, Arctic Program Director for the Wilderness Society. She serves on the Ocean Energy Safety Advisory Committee for the Department of Interior's Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement. I appreciate you talking to us.
Thank you very much. Thanks for covering this.
Thank you. You can find more of our coverage on the Kulik. John Ryan did an investigative piece that's on KUOW.org that looked at how it was faring, how the efforts to create a containment dome have fared in tests earlier this year. You can find all that at KUOW.org.
Fans of Downton Abbey have so many questions. Are those costumes uncomfortable? Is that castle real? And what about the kitchen?
The authenticity of everything we use is genuine. The food is genuine. Everything is as you see it there.
I'm David Green, Mr. Carson the Butler, and the cast of Downton Abbey on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That story and much more tomorrow morning from 5 until 9 o'clock. Good morning, it's 9:39. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information.
Support for KUOW comes from the Irritable Bowel Syndrome Treatment Center, specializing in IBS, food allergies and sensitivities, celiac disease, and related digestive problems. Details on customized treatment options at IBSTreatmentCenter.com or on Facebook.
We have sunny skies and 39 degrees in the University District. We're expecting sun all day, the high getting up to 41. It's going to be partly cloudy tonight, the low near 31. We're expecting clouds tomorrow with a chance of rain in the afternoon. Tomorrow's high in the low 40s.
David Wagner, master poet of the Northwest, joins us. Professor, a novelist, his work is known for its references to the natural world. He's the author of 10 novels?
Yeah.
10 novels. His most recent books include The House of Song, Good Morning and Good Night, A Map of the Night, and After the Point of No Return. Speaking at Benaroya Hall on January 16th as part of Seattle Arts and Lectures, our excuse for you being willing to come in and talk to us. I appreciate it.
I'm very glad to be here.
It was one of these mornings, wasn't it? One of these great Northwest mornings where the Olympics were shining and the
Yes,
Cascades
indeed, and no snow up to my knees in places where I grew up.
Inspiring? Is that the kind of vision that has been inspiring you to see the Olympics glistening like that over the water?
Well, it's inspiring in a peculiar way because I don't go there anymore. And it used to be a place that was magic for me. But my legs won't work as well as they should if you go anywhere near the mountains.
Does that change your relationship with the things you write about?
A little bit, I suppose. I've been partly suburbanized, but it still haunts my imagination, and I remember very well and intensely too, what it was like to be part of that natural world, undisturbed, after coming from a ruined place.
You know, I wanted to ask you, I'll jump to that, a ruined place, Ohio, Indiana.
Between Gary and Chicago in particular.
Oh, well, you were in the ruined place then.
Yeah,
where was that? Where were you at? In Gary?
Indiana.
Whiting. Yeah.
Right on the city limits of Chicago.
So you were where everything was either built or it was industrial or former industrial.
Exactly. And they perfected all forms of pollution there before they even called it that.
Where were you a reporter?
The Hammond Times and the Seattle PI.
So when you're at the PI.
Yeah.
When you were doing it in Indiana, Did you feel despair for what had happened to the environment? Was that something that was front and center in your consciousness?
No, I was born in eastern Ohio, in a town of 25,000, and was familiar with farm country and that rolling grassy land of eastern Ohio, and then moved at the age of 7. To between Gary and Chicago, where there are more steel mills than Pittsburgh and the world's largest single oil refinery, Standard Oil of Indiana.
There's kind of a tang in the air, too, a metallic tang in the air.
Yes, it depended on the wind. There was also Lever Brothers and the city dump and all kinds of things.
So is it really true that when you came out here, you were sort of awestruck by the world?
I was absolutely dumbfounded by the greenness and the richness and the wildness of this area. Back then, I doubt whether it's true anymore. You could drive for less than an hour in any direction except underwater and be in a place that showed no trace of man.
I doubt it's true anymore either.
Yeah.
That's a little bit unnerving in and of itself, is it not?
It certainly is. Well, this was 1954.
Yeah. Does that knowledge affect your most recent poems, that this land follows the path that Indiana might have taken?
Well, it hasn't gone that far. I mean, you'd really need to work at it
I don't think you, do you really need to work at it that hard?
Yes, indeed. I think that this is still a really wonderful, wild place if you edit it sufficiently in your travels.
Well, you know, I was looking at poems from different places, and this morning I opened the Oxford Book of American Poetry.
Yes.
And I have two questions about that. One, since you mentioned if you edit it sufficiently, Dead Letter from Out of Town, do you recall that poem?
Yes, I do.
Well, that's the, I guess, the flip side of the natural world when you come to some of the towns and what you see.
Yes,
this poem sort of explores that.
Dick Hugo wasn't talking about the natural world in that.
Well, he wasn't talking about the natural world in his The Triggering Town, right?
Yes.
When I feel a northwest town may trigger a poem, before I start writing, I assume one or more of the following. David Wagner has seen the town, assessed it realistically, and decided it is a good place to steer clear of. And then you wrote a poem. Dick, you were right. I steer clear to that town. What was that town? Wasn't that one of those northwest towns that you were writing about?
Well, I was talking about Dick Hugo's version of that town. He saw it through jaundiced eyes, I think. Though he was stubbornly realistic in his vision. At the same time, he was a curious mixture of cynic and lover, of small town west and northwest. You'd have to read the poems
that he
to
wrote
to know how he connected himself with the various disappointments and malfunctions of small town America.
So this isn't your vision of small town America. Where's that? The dork who looks good for an afternoon of heartbreaking BS, I edit, has a badge in his wallet and specializes in busting down on their luck nomads who laugh too much.
Well, my relationship with Richard Hugo and his poetry is a very complicated one. We used to criticize each other. We would trade poems in the Blue Moon in early days and tell each other what we should have done instead of what we did. So I guess I'm doing some of that in this particular poem, too.
Is that helpful to trade poems in the Blue Moon Did you learn from any of, maybe not the Hugo part of it, but did you learn from stuff like that back in the 50s?
Absolutely, of course. And James Wright, the poet, was often there, too. We were all students of Theodore Retke and interfered with each other's progress in healthy ways, I guess. Kept each other from going awry and sobered us up about our accomplishments.
Even as you were drinking beer.
Yes, indeed.
David Wagner's our guest, the poet, the novelist. Came here in 1954. I was curious about one other thing before I jump up to your career, because right next to you is Lou Welch in this poetry book. And what was, and you mentioned Retke, you have Hugo. What was your relationship during that time with the wandering poets who came through town? Kerouac, Ginsberg, Welch, the others. How did you, did you see yourself as an academic poet then? You were attached to the university?
I'm afraid I was more of that than I should have been by then. I met all those guys. I mean, I knew Allen Ginsberg.
I imagine you drank with them at the Blue Moon.
No, not the ones you mentioned.
No.
I mean, academic in comparison with James Wright and Hugo?
No, I meant academic in terms of attached to an institution. That's all I meant.
Oh, I see. Well, the institution Hugo was attached to was Boeing. If I had my choice between the University of Washington and Boeing, I think I would choose the University of Washington. And James Wright was equally academic. He was a graduate student and got his PhD in English at the University of Washington. before going on to teach elsewhere. So I was no more academic than they.
What did you think I was meaning when I said academic poet, and you said I should have been a little less like that? What was your thinking?
When you mentioned Kerouac, I thought of the beat poets who were affiliated with that group. And there was a revolution in American poetry going on at that time. I went to one of the early readings of Howl, given by Allen Ginsberg at Farrington Hall on campus. Stanley Kunitz was teaching here then. And got an earful of what Allen Ginsberg was doing. And I, in comparison with him and his cohorts, I was metallically academic, yes. And I got over it. To a certain extent, it was true.
You got over it.
Yeah, I don't think I'm an academic poet anymore.
And in that interpretation of definition of academic poet, what are we talking about?
We're talking about rigidity of form, chiefly. Academic critics ruled the book reviews, and it's part of the reason that Allen Ginsberg was a very healthy influence on generations. He made it seem easy to write poems again after the great difficulties of the academic world.
Is that a good thing? Making it seem easy to write poems?
Well, it happens in every generation. Somebody comes along and makes it all seem simple. And it isn't, of course. It is often very difficult. But you have to disguise the difficulties, in my opinion. And we're living in a time now where there are no rules. Or if you invent a rule, if you're so fortunate as to be able to invent a rule for the writing of poetry that nobody else has thought of, you'll be congratulated, because it gives thousands of poets a chance to violate it.
Who's done that of late, invented a rule?
Oh, I don't know. I don't read the critics, but I'm sure they keep trying to. There are magazines devoted to formal poetry, to rigidly academic poetry, who want exact rhymes and regular meter and all of the old apparatus, always, without exception, who have rebelled against free verse.
Poetry Northwest, founded it in 1966. What was your goal?
It wasn't founded in 1966. It was founded in 1959 by Carolyn Kaiser. I took over in 1966.
My bad. Or that's not okay. Not actually my bad, but this guy's bad. But in any ways, go ahead.
Yeah, well, what about it?
What was your goal? What was your goal for taking over at that point?
Well, I don't know what my goal was.
Well, it was a job?
A chance by the head of the English department to take it over, because Carolyn Kaiser was going to Washington, D.C. to be head of the literary program of the National Endowment for the Arts. And they needed an editor. Part of the lure was that it represented half my academic work. I only had to teach half time as well as editing. But I was very wary about editing. I was afraid, because I had seen it happen to so many other poets who became editors, I was afraid I would turn into a gray, strange, silent poet. And I put my toe in the water very carefully, ready to resign at any time if I felt that was happening to me.
David Wagner's our guest. Well, it must not have happened if you were editor for 36 years.
No, it didn't. I found out that, like teaching, the teaching, writing, and editing became a kind of three-way feed. Every bit of work I put into one helped me with the others. I was fortunate in this respect. I don't think this has happened to very many editors.
Is that because of your demeanor, or was there something else?
No idea. I may just have been able to be three people, to wear three hats. Some people can't do that.
Did you stop writing novels after, when was your last novel, 1981?
It was published in 1981, I think.
So did you stop writing prose fiction after that?
No, I kept on for a while, but it was a losing proposition. I never gave enough of my time and attention to revising fiction. I wasn't wholehearted enough. The way I decided at about that time that if I spent 6 months writing a novel that wasn't published, I was wasting very valuable time. And I think I wrote altogether 22 novels and published 10 and a half. I managed to make a short novel out of one of them that got published in a magazine. But that's not enough. I mean, that's not good enough. And it wasn't the fault of the novel. It was my fault. I simply was too eager to get back to writing poetry.
Oh, that's interesting. So the poetry always was was the center of your heart?
I finally had to feel that was true, yes. Though I had consistent, they wouldn't go away, feelings that I should be a playwright, too.
Did you do those?
Yeah, I finally had a play produced by ACT in 2006. 45 performances called First Class.
How did you feel seeing those as opposed to being the writer of poems? How did you see that performance?
Well, it was a remarkable relief.
That it was done?
I had been the so-called playwright in residence at the Seattle Repertory Theater, thanks to a Ford grant in 1964. And they kept me on for 8 years as literary advisor. I've been a theater person, sort of stage happy in the past, and finally it came true.
Well, that's
thanks
good.
Chiefly to John Aylward and Kurt Beatty.
They just wanted it. They wanted you to get it on the stage.
That's true.
They pushed you there. Tell me about After the Point of No Return, your latest.
I don't know what to tell you about it, except that it's, I think, 94 poems that I have written since the last book. I always make sure that they've been in magazines first, so I have some sort of comfort from an editor before I commit them to a book. So there's that about it.
Yeah, that's good. That's fair enough. The editor has given you that stamp of approval that you still like to have, huh?
Yeah.
Just like you like to give to the poets who would submit to you.
Yes.
All right. David Wagner is going to be talking, reading poems, part of Seattle Arts and Lectures on the 16th of January, so Wednesday, 2 weeks, at 7:30. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
And now, the sound of the day.
Today's sound comes from a night market in Thailand, sent to us by our bicycle correspondent, Willie Weir. Over the noise of dozens of food stalls, loud advertising campaign from a local business, he heard a single voice rising up from the crowd, this voice you're hearing. It's the voice of a man, a blind man, singing a folk tune. He's accompanying himself on a three-stringed instrument, a little bigger than a ukulele. He was wandering through the dining area with a tin cup attached to his instrument. Well, you may not be in Thailand, but you're hearing sounds of your day. Share them with us. Record 30 seconds and send us to weekday at KUOW.org. Sound of the day in the subject line. Stay with us.
Good morning, it's 9:59. Headlines from NPR News are coming up next. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Hedvig and the Angry Inch, a co-production with Balogun Theatre starring Jarek Hoffer, live at the Moore Theatre January 15th.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.